Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
And a good day from the making of the John Batchelor Show. I welcome my colleagues, Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, a senior fellow, and also a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, Hussein Haqqani. I mentioned that the headlines this morning in London, the ones I pay attention to, why? Because they don't have a dog in the partisan fight. Therefore, I take at that one layer of twist. The headlines run to European problems. And the Iran war, it gets attention, but way down in the scale compared to the other concerns about European banking, about the EU, and whether Britain wants to join again, and the question of the president's visit to China. We do get this headline, Iran war hits Americans with a $40 billion fuel bill. That is a surprising statistic. But we can all feel it at the pump. The question of the Gulf comes to a technical question about clearing it of mines. That reminds me to count again how many minesweepers are available if you use the European allies as your source. As of now, I do not believe the Trump administration has made a decision about that. So while the Gulf is not top of the mind in Europe, it certainly is here. Given the lack of clarity from the Trump administration. So, gentlemen, I turn to your thoughts, not specifically on tactics of the day, how many tankers get through, how many turn off their transponders, where the tankers come from. Are they coming from Qatar with liquefied natural gas? Or are they coming from Iran? Are they coming from Kuwait? I turn attention to the general story, the larger story about the Iran war, week 7 or 8. I lose track. Bill, I begin with you. The Iran story is right now familiar to me only in terms of the dragged out contest in Iraq that came to nothing and the dragged out contest in Afghanistan after 20 years that came to either a defeat or nothing, depending on your point of view. How do you see the Iran story spilling out now? It's surprisingly becoming normalized. Good day to you.
Good day, John. Yeah, it's becoming normalized as we're all experiencing the price hikes due to this war. So one thing you could ignore about Afghanistan or Iraq, unless you were a family or friends who, you know, had someone serving who was killed or injured in Iraq and Afghanistan, the wider American public could largely ignore those wars. This one can't be ignored due to the economic impact of this war. My takeaway from over the weekend from President Trump's latest threats is, you know, it's becoming tiring to be honest with you. I mean, how many times is President Trump going to threaten Iran, to bomb Iran back into the Stone Age? Either follow through with these threats or come to a solution. I just think everyone's starting to tune it out. I mean, me as an analyst, this is my job, and I'm beginning to tune out what's happening, at least what's being said from the White House, because you see President Trump make grandiose statements. You see, you know, I'm being told that there was a massive military victory here, and yet the Iranians still control the Strait of Hormuz.
Mr. Ambassador, the wolf story is universal, moms to children. This does begin to appear to be wolf. Your brief thoughts here, and then we'll start recording our understanding of the war. Good morning to you.
Good morning. The question is, who's the wolf here? I mean, the one who's crying wolf. What options does he have? And if he has options, why hasn't he exercised them for so long? There's a report on Reuters today, since you follow English news sources, which says that the war has already cost global companies $25 billion. They're not talking about the American consumer. They're talking about the corporations. That will have an effect also on the overall economic picture. Everybody I talk to is complaining about the price of gas having almost doubled. And by the way, even in the Gulf region, the price of oil has doubled, because even though they have lots of crude under their soil, that doesn't mean they have enough refined gasoline to fuel the cars and the planes that are taking off from there. So the cost of the war is rising. The Iranians are still there. Their control of the Straits of Hormuz is a bit of a pain in the neck for everyone, but nobody wants to do or seems to want to do what needs to be done to change that. And lastly, remember, the demining operation, etc., is not going to be a matter of a couple of days. It could take a much longer time. So the after effects of the war will continue long after President Trump has given an Oval Office speech saying, we have driven Iran. Because what's stopping him from saying that? This morning I woke up last night in my dream. I saw Iran completely back in the Stone Age. And as far as the American public is concerned, they should believe me, and the war is over. Still, the effects of the war will be still there. What are we going to do about them?
Reminds me of the solution we had for Vietnam when I was a callow youth, Mr. Ambassador. We said, declare the victory. Nobody will challenge you. Let's go home.
Well, so, I can't remember the senator who actually said that to Lyndon Johnson, from where this phrase came. It was a Southern senator who said, Lyndon, why don't you just declare victory and get the hell out? And from that came this phrase that all of us who were, I mean, I was still at high school, since I'm a couple of years younger than you are. But I remember this very distinctly because it featured in Time magazine at that time, declare victory and get out. I'll remember the name of the senator in a minute and remind it. But yeah, so I hope that the problem is there's nobody who can tell that to President Trump. He doesn't listen to anyone. And so Johnson, who was told, also didn't listen to anyone. And we had the war drag on until 1974.
If it's still not a problem for the people of Southeast Asia, given all the damage that was done to their children. However, we turn to the larger story of what does it mean for us? Even though the Financial Times is not worried, Reuters has a couple of headlines, but they're not worried. Why is it we're treating this as if just another day in Afghanistan, just another day in Iraq, just another day in Ukraine? We'll start immediately, gentlemen. And I have a Pakistan deploying jet aircraft and troops to Saudi Arabia, Mr. Ambassador. I'll begin with you. That is striking that Pakistan is staying involved in this conflict. Heretofore, it's been a neutral site for the for conversation, and now it looks to be backing up its muscle. So we begin. This is the taping of the making of the John Batchelor Show, about to become the John Batchelor Show with my two colleagues. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is, I'm out of clock. Come on, clock. The only non-digital thing I have is my clock, and it's cranky. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow, Foundation for Defense of Democracy, my colleague, and our colleague, Hussein Haqqani, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Mr. Ambassador, I begin with you because Reuters features a big headline showing high-performance aircraft flying in close contact with each other, quite martial. And the headline is, Pakistan deploys jet squadron, thousands of troops to Saudi Arabia during Iran war. Subhead, Pakistan has deployed 8,000 troops, a squadron of fighter jets, and an air defense system to Saudi Arabia under a mutual defense pact, ramping up military cooperation with Riyadh, even as Islamabad serves as the main mediator in the Iran war. Mr. Ambassador, this is, to me, a fresh information that Pakistan is getting so deeply involved in the Gulf and would appear to be not picking sides, but certainly paying attention to those who need air defense and other support systems. What is it that we can make of this Pakistan-Riyadh conversation? Is this a positive?
Yeah, so first of all, Pakistan had done this deployment right after the war started. If you read the story carefully, actually, it's not talking about a new deployment. It's talking about the deployment that was done within a few days to reassure the Saudis. 8,000 troops were sent and two squadrons, mainly of one squadron, I think, of JF-17 aircraft made by the Chinese. And then there were some other air defense systems that Pakistan deployed there. Pakistan actually used that as a talking point with the Iranians, saying, look, guys, we are your next door neighbor, and we don't want to be dragged into this war, which is why we are offering our mediation. And President Trump is willing to listen to us. And now if you are willing to listen to us, fine. We will have these forces in Saudi Arabia in a defensive posture, but not do anything to you. But guys, unless you talk, this is not going to move forward, and it'll become more difficult for you because then many regional actors, including us, would have to get involved. So they played it to their advantage. Now, Bill and I both know that Pakistan often acts in sort of ways that confounds everybody else. They go right when they intend to go left, and yet they manage to get wherever they want. Their problem is that their economy doesn't function and they need handouts every now and then. And right now it's the Saudis giving the handouts, so they are there to defend the realm.
If I remember correctly, the border between Pakistan and Iran is not secure, and there's been a complaining and violence for years along that border. Is that correct, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, the border between Pakistan and Iran is a region called Balochistan, which is a bit like the Kurdish areas in further west. Basically, tribes that have been divided due to recent political history between Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And they really don't follow any border. They move freely along those borders. The Baluch in Pakistan have been waging war for autonomy or independence. The Iranian Baluch, who are Sunni, have also not been very supportive of the regime. So that region is a turbulent area and an area where traditional meanings of border and authority just do not hold.
Bill, I come to you on your thoughts about the not only Pakistan, as Mr. Ambassador says very discreetly, not always predictable, and afterwards you puzzled what it means. However, since the commander-in-chief in Pakistan enjoyed great warm welcome in the Oval Office, he seems to have been promoted in the eyes of the president. Is this all a positive, Bill?
I view nothing that occurs with Pakistan when Pakistani officials are feted by the U.S. administration, whether it be Republican or Democrat. That's never positive to me, just after what we witnessed in Afghanistan, how Pakistan played all sides. You know, Hussein, of course, read my mind about how Pakistan confounds us. As usual, Pakistan is playing all sides here. It deploys troops and fighters and air defense systems to Saudi Arabia. Yet it allows Iranian aircraft, which are being targeted by the U.S. and Israel, to land inside of Pakistan to seek safe harbor. And then it provides mediation. You know, this is straight out of the Pakistani playbook where, you know, President Trump should not be saying the Pakistanis are a force of good here or force of peace. Anytime Pakistan gets involved, in my mind, you should be looking very, very skeptically. They do not have the U.S. interests at heart, nor should Pakistan. It should have its own interests at heart, of course. That's what states should do for their citizens. But that doesn't mean that everything is going well for us, and we should have learned our lessons with dealing with the Pakistanis during the war in Afghanistan.
Gentlemen, I turn to the Iran story because it dominates the thinking in Washington. But if I read the headlines in the Financial Times and also include Reuters, it is not dominating the news reporting in Europe. So the open question here is, with the president's attention to India, with the on-again, off-again nature of the so-called blockade by both Iran and the U.S., with various tankers following through the Straits of Hormuz, some turning their transponders off, some perhaps paying ransom, some perhaps being favored by one side or the other, it would appear that the Straits of Hormuz are a talking point more than they are a battle zone. Mr. Ambassador, how do you view this idea that the insurance companies are in charge or somebody else is in charge, not the U.S. Navy and not the IRGC, and that we're locked up in some kind of rhetorical game?
Yeah, we are in a rhetorical game. We must remember that for blockades and things like that or sanctions, the most important thing is credibility and consistency. If you know how to run a blockade, the blockade doesn't work. If you know how to violate sanctions with impunity and not have a higher price to pay than abiding by sanction, you do it. So very frankly, right now, very clearly, Iran has not paid enough of a price in its own view to have to bend. And as far as the blockade is concerned, I don't think that that is as firm a blockade as has been said in the United States. And you talk about the Iran war no longer being in European headlines. Is it really in American headlines, except in terms of how people really are having to pay more for the fuel at their pumps? The president every day says something. No one actually even calls them out and says, "Oh, but by the way, you said the same thing. You say you're going to destroy Iran tomorrow, but you had said a few days ago that you had already destroyed Iran's capabilities." So if Iran's capabilities are destroyed, who is it that is harassing shipping in the Straits of Hormuz? If Iran has no boats, his words were no boats, no planes, nothing left. Remember that one, Bill? And when they have nothing left, now what's going on? So the American public also has kind of switched out on President Trump's assertions. They just want him to make that speech about ending the war and somehow lowering the price of gas. That's what everybody is waiting for in the U.S., it seems to me.
Bill, I come to you. We've got rhetorical questions for you. Is this a war, and is it wolf-wolf? And where is the Iran story in the American mind? Is it Afghanistan level, which is very slow? Is it Iraq level, which was upsetting at the time, politically upsetting? How do you grade the threat, given that we can't actually say where the front line is?
You know, Hussein echoed a lot of my thoughts on this. And this war, unlike Iraq and Afghanistan, and if you had your son or your daughter or your brother or sister or a friend of the family was a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan and they were killed or wounded or even deployed, you would notice those wars, right? This is the kind of war right now where the only real effect that's being felt is in the pocketbook. And it's hitting hard. I mean, gas is approaching $5 a gallon on the East Coast. Other prices are increasing. Americans are noticing that. So this is what gets America's attention. This is why the American public doesn't cares. I don't think the American public really cares about a war with Iran, about whether Iran gets nuclear weapons or not. That's something that Washington cares about and should care about. But this war, and, you know, Hussein is right. President Trump, how many times has he told us that Iran has military has been destroyed, that there's no boats, there's no planes, that it can't do anything with its military? Yet who controls the Strait of Hormuz? People are beginning to tune out President Trump. That is not something that's positive for him if he wants to prosecute this war. I believe that all wars should be prosecuted with the support of the American public. He went into this war with low support, below 50%. It's not going to get any better the longer this drags out and the more that Americans feel the pain in their wallet.
And if I may make a quick point, he has totally ignored both the American people and America's allies in the region. And he said that famously last week, I think, that I don't pay attention to the financial suffering of people. I don't think he meant it that way. But what he meant was, I have greater goals to pursue in terms of finishing off Iran's nuclear program, et cetera, et cetera. But then get on with it. Don't keep dragging your feet, because the people of the United States are suffering, and the region is suffering, and the region is America's friend. Each of the Gulf countries has some commitment given to it by the United States that is right now not being fully fulfilled. They have allowed their bases to be used, and they have come under attack. And today the CENTCOM commander has said that the United States did help all the Gulf countries in their defense against Iranian missiles and drones. But surely that is not the same as saying that the source of the pain for these Gulf countries has actually been eliminated, and the U.S. was expected to do that.
I'm speaking with Hossein Haqqani, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, and Bill Raggio, a senior fellow for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. When we come back, what does Washington make of the Iran war? Is it top of the mind in the lawmakers? Is it top of the mind in the professional Council on Foreign Relations thinking? I'm John Batchelor. I go immediately to Hossein Haqqani, former ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, now at the Hudson Institute, to help me understand what Washington makes of the Iran war. Now, it's called Iran war by Reuters. It's called Iran war by Financial Times. However, when you turn to Washington's headlines, they're wrapped up in the popularity of the president, the anticipation of the midterms, anticipating another baseball season or football season, the ordinary affair of a crowded city that's coming to life again, and adjusting its bottom line to what we can ask Congress to give us from the Trump administration budget this year. Are we going to have to build the arch to get our budget met? Are we have to a garden? Is that a good idea? In other words, it's saying what I hear is everything but Iran. Is it anywhere in Washington that somebody's worried about this?
Well, I mean, just pick up the newspaper, the major newspaper of Washington today. What number headline is it? What page is Iran on? Here are the headlines right now. I've got it open in front of me. It's seven charts that explain why the job market is so tough right now. A European rule could devastate American farmers. The stock market has got to tune out Trump. Mamdani's astonishing first veto. And then, of course, Trump plans to build helipad at White House. Helipads, ballrooms, those are the priority there. The American soldiers, and thank God that the casualties have been very low in this war compared to past wars. But nobody's paying attention to all of that. Here's the bottom line. Washington is no longer... is no longer the center of America's global leadership, because there is no American global leadership. All we have is two warring parties, one trying to see how it can maximize its advantage from high gas prices and win the election by telling the voters that, oh, look at this president, his war has made you poorer and made life more difficult for you. And the other playing defense, saying, no, there are other things that you need to look at. This is not what you should worry about. Don't look at your pocketbooks. Don't look at how you are being affected. Look at the great grand things that are being done to make America great again.
Bill, is anybody in Washington upset or angry or frustrated or pounding the table the way they did during Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, you know, again, yet again, Hossein is correct. You know, Iran and Washington these days, it seems to me, unless you're in deep foreign policy, you know, if this is your issue, beyond that, it's really just a gotcha. It's on one side, it's look, yeah, look at how the U.S., how the The Trump administration is failing. And on the other side, it's, we've succeeded. Look at this military victory. The press is wrong. Fake news. And that's really what the Iran story has come down to. I have to agree. I mean, our leadership, and this isn't just under the Trump administration, it's under successive administrations. Our global leadership has diminished year by year because of the partisan squabbling. You know, the old adage is that it stops at the water's edge, right? The partisan politics stops at the water's edge. That stopped during the second Gulf War after the U.S. invaded Iraq, and it has eroded American leadership worldwide significantly over the last 23 years since the U.S. invaded Iraq.
There was a very interesting story on Reuters, again, titled Trump says Iran war is worth the economic pain. These rural voters agree. The reporter had gone to a small...
30 seconds, Mr. Ambassador. Well, we lost him a little bit, Bill.
Yes, we did.
What we have here is, can anybody here play this game? That's what's going on.
What happened?
You dropped out a little bit. Please start again.
Okay.
30 seconds. We have 30 seconds.
I don't know if you saw a Reuters report about Colorado voters who still support Trump. And the reporter basically reported from a Colorado county that is pro-Trump and people are still pro him. And they're saying they support the Iran war not because of any other factor, but because they hate the Democrats so much. Now, this hate... if that is the defining factor, how do you expect anything positive to come out of Washington's current political deliberations and discussions?
Hussein Haqqani of the Hudson Institute, Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm John Batchelor. Well done, gentlemen. We got through it. There was one break, but not too bad.
I'm sorry. Something happened on my side, I think.
It's okay.
It's a business thing. Saying, I wanted to piggyback on your point, and I've seen it on the other side just this weekend. A good friend of mine, left leaning,
hates they Trump oppose the war. So much stupid arguments. Exactly.
Hates so much that he believes that every assassination attempt against the president was staged. That President Trump had someone shoot him in the ear.
Having registered myself as an independent voter the day after I became an American citizen, I tell you, I am just fed up with this partisanship. I mean, why can't you just be reasonable, folks? You know, Iran is a threat. Yes, of course. But then there are people who would say, Iran is not a threat if Trump says so. Why? You know, it was a threat when Biden said it, but it's not a threat when Trump says it. I mean, there's something crazy in this country that is really worrying me, especially, you know, my grandchild has now been born as an American citizen. My children are all American citizens. I worry about my country.
Well, let me ask your measure, because you see Washington's temperament very closely. The question here is, does Iran matter to anybody? In other words, we have a lame duck president. Now, ignore that it's Donald Trump. Any lame duck president loses power at the midterms. Is that what we're watching, Mr. Ambassador? Just ordinary fare. Bill Clinton even lost power in the last 2 years of his term.
Well, I mean, when the president loses control of the legislature, he does lose a lot of his power. But in international affairs, there has been a tradition of people reaching across the aisle to pay attention to things that are deemed as threats to the United States. What is happening now is people define threats on the basis of whose side they are on rather than what threatens the U.S.
Yeah. And Bill, your opinion of right now, any foreign policy matter, is it dominating the story in Washington? Price of gasoline is not foreign affairs, Bill.
No, price of gasoline isn't foreign affairs, but it is as well, because our foreign affairs created this, right? This is what I think the Trump administration doesn't want to take credit for, is that its policies has caused an economic impact, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. I still think Washington It's as Hussein said, it's about partisan squabbling. Iran is seen through the lens of partisan politics. Every foreign, you know, Ukraine through the lens of partisan politics, you name it. People just don't look at these things individually and judge. I can look at every administration that I've been covering this war for, these wars for 20 plus years. There's things with the Bush administration did I agree with, and some I didn't. Same with the Obama administration. Same with the Biden administration. Same with the Trump administration. And when I have conversations with people, you know, because they ask me, well, they know what I do for a living. And it's difficult to explain this to people that, like, I actually can support a Biden decision or an Obama decision or a Bush decision or a Trump decision or not support it because, like, you know, they have to view it through their partisanship. And I'm with you saying this is what really concerns me moving forward is that we've become I don't know how to define it, you know, politically clannish, I guess I would say. And it's destructive to the future of this country.
All right, let me ask you one brief question, gentlemen, then we'll turn to another conflict. Right now, is Iran going to go away quietly? Mr. Ambassador?
Oh, did we lose him? Oh, he's back.
No, he's
I don't think Iran will go away quietly. Mm-hmm. For one thing, the Iranians will make sure, or the Iranian regime will make sure they don't go away quietly. Israel is similarly divided as the U.S. is along tribal lines, and so they have an election coming. The Iranian wish would be that the Israeli election and the American election somehow puts dealing with Iran on the back burner, giving them more time. But it's not going to go away. It'll come back in 6 months, 8 months, 1 year. After all, Iran with nuclear weapons is going to be a problem, and somebody will have to do something to stop them from it.
Bill, your thinking, is Iran going to go away quietly so we hardly notice?
I don't believe Iran is going to go away quietly. I think it recognizes it's taken its pain. I think it's ready to take more pain. Unless the administration is serious about seeing it through, which I think the administration sent all the wrong messages by continuing to threaten Iran but do nothing. I think the Iranians recognize that time is on its side and that no matter how depleted its military capacity is, it could still threaten the Gulf. And that is ultimately far more power to the Iranian regime than a nuclear weapon or ballistic missiles. Its control, and the regime said it itself, that they've discovered that control of the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandeb, that is its nuclear weapon.
Mr. Ambassador, I thank you very much. Bill, I thank you very much. We will return to Iran because we may be the only people in America covering this story. It's possible. Thank you. And Bill, I'll be right back with you. I've got to make sure I've got the connections with Sam set up.
I did send him a link to that you sent me. Is that the?
Yeah, you send that on to Sam.
I passed the link along to Sam. Yes.
We're going to Hamas, and there's news in Hamas, much news in Hamas matters. Primary concern right now is the war fighting situation in Gaza with the strike on the commander of Hamas's gang, however you want to characterize it, that launched the attack October 7th, 2023. What we have now is a question of what is to be done with the Board of Peace, with Hamas's. I'm looking to see if, I believe Ben has joined us, Bill.
Roger that.
I'm getting him up here. I'm punching buttons while I'm talking. There he is. Good morning, Sam. Thank you very much for joining us so quickly. We have major news out of Hamas about the targeted killing of a Hamas commander who's associated with the October 7th attack. And I believe I heard them say on Reuters, this is the last of the commanders that can be associated or they're something like that, a major kill. So we want to start with you, and I want to start recording right away with your permission. Bill, are you okay?
Always ready to go.
I've got some wind sound on your mic. Does that make sense?
Let me go ahead and close my door here. Sorry.
All right. Okay, Bill, where's the making of the show?
Yeah. Is that a dog?
That is the dog.
Ah, very nice.
Bill, introduce your lab. Well, to him.
He's right down there.
Oh, that's cute.
My co-host.
Yeah. He gets restless when Bill's talking too much and starts moving around behind him.
And or then, when I forget to slip him treats in between.
Yeah, and we talk openly of how Bill's going to go for a walk right after this. Yes, sir, a lengthy walk. One of your favorite moments of the day, no problem. One of the joys of having a canine around is that every day is a party for them. Absolutely every day.
It's true. And
they go from being in despair when nobody will walk them to being, on the roof because they're so excited.
A little bipolar, but yes, it's great.
All right, we're going to begin with Hamas. Just a moment. Let me get the headline up. Thank you. Sam, the number of released Hamas killers, do we know how many released? I remember 2,000. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's about right. I don't know if there's an exact number that is out there because there were multiple releases sort of throughout different stages of the war, and then many of them have been killed since they rejoined Hamas. But yeah, I think that's a good estimate.
And my concern is that there are courtrooms to handle killers such as the ones who participated in October 7th. To your knowledge, is there a plan to go forward with a court similar to how they handled the Nazi killers?
So actually, Israel just passed a law that allows for terrorists to receive the death penalty. We'll see. I don't think there have been convictions or executions yet, though I haven't tracked it that closely, so I wouldn't be comfortable saying that I know that for sure. But that is definitely a change in Israeli posture on how they see and deal with terrorists, because the concern is this will just happen again and these people will be back on the streets. But if we, execute them, then they can't rejoin Hamas in a prisoner deal later.
All right, we'll begin immediately, gentlemen. Thank you. Bill, you all set?
Ready to go.
5, 4, 3. And thank you, Sam.
Of course.
4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio, my colleague and co-host, is here with me, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And we're very pleased to welcome Samuel Ben-Or, reporting for the FTD, a research analyst, to comment on certainly the centerpiece story, Hamas commander Adad targeted an Israeli strike because he was considered one of the commanders of the October 7th massacre. And we have a report about the massacre now that is exceedingly upsetting. I don't recommend any of you read it. I certainly don't recommend anyone seek out to see the video that was made from the head cameras of some of these, let's put it this way, alleged killers. However, the report is just the underlining basis for what is to be done with the Hamas commanders and soldiers who participated in that horror. And Sam, a very good day to you. The death of, his name is Izzaldin al-Haddad, said to be one of the commanders in Hamas. We know at some point what the thinking is about the October 7th attackers. Is there a general understanding that we're seeking them out even though there's a ceasefire? Or is there a general understanding that they cannot receive sanctuary if they travel to Istanbul or Doha, that we're going to track them down anyway? What does the Prime Minister's cabinet, what does he say about these particular Hamas killers? Good day to you, Sam.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. So this is the biggest elimination in Gaza since Mohammed Sinwar's brother was killed a number of months ago. Haddad was the commander of the military wing of Hamas, and because they're on war footing right now, he was essentially controlling the organization. And as you pointed out, there are very few people left from that organization that can be said to have some continuity from when the war started. So in terms of named figures who were operating Hamas, before and during the October 7th attacks and indeed helped plan them. Haddad was the last one. That being said, the reason for it was reportedly linked to Hamas's refusal to disarm. And when Israel sees that they're not doing this key priority for Israel, then they have to try to roll the dice and see if they can take out some of these hardline figures that are driving the recalcitrance, which of course is the entire organization. So I don't expect that this will work, and Hamas will now say, okay, we'll disarm because you killed our fifth military commander, you know, in the war, but this one we'll disarm for. In terms of posture towards Nakba terrorists, who are the ones who carried out the October 7th attacks primarily, along with many Palestinian civilians. Maybe it's wrong to call them civilians, but anyway, Israel has made it a priority to continue targeting them as it conducts retaliatory strikes in Gaza for violations of the ceasefire. They'll often explicitly say, we eliminated a terrorist today who participated in the October 7th attacks, who was part of the Nakba force. And they're clearly making it a priority to eliminate as many of these particular terrorists as possible.
Bill, you have a question for Sam.
Hey, Sam. The Israelis are supposed to have a ceasefire in Gaza. How do they justify his killing? Is that because they say that he was working to violate the ceasefire? Or is it justification enough that he was one of the military commanders involved in the October 7th attacks?
I would argue this has more to do with the ceasefire than anything else. Of course, Israel wants to eliminate every terrorist who was involved with that attack, but they certainly could have eliminated Haddad before. The main constraint pre-ceasefire was that he, like Sinwar, had surrounded himself with Israeli hostages, which made it hard to target him. But the ceasefire has been going for about 6 months, and given Israel's intelligence penetration, it's almost certain that they could have eliminated him before this had they wanted to. The reason I think they're doing this now is because the ceasefire is not only has Hamas under Haddad violated the ceasefire well over 100 times, and that's just what myself and my colleague Aaron have tracked, but they've also shown a total unwillingness to even discuss disarming, which is the next key priority. So this is part of also a increased pressure campaign that the IDF is operating somewhat under the radar. But there is this fascinating moment yesterday where Netanyahu talked about how Israel had, since basically the Iran war started, taken control of additional territory within Gaza. So before I came on the show a week ago and said that the split was 53% is controlled by Israel, 47% is by Hamas. Now Israel controls 60%. Of the Gaza Strip. And this is part of a way to pressure Hamas, along with some other diplomatic moves that we can go into later.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Sam, because it's been a story that I can't quite get a hold of, and then it slips away from me. The hostages are all returned, living and dead. Why negotiate at all? Why hold back at all? Every senior figure in Hamas is guilty. Every senior figure in Hamas sustains the Hamas recruiting. Israel's repeated claim is they're going to end Hamas, not mow the grass, end it, tear up the yard, turn it into concrete, end. So where are we in this? Why talk to anybody? Why let Cairo or Istanbul or Doha offer refuge? You've said you're going to end it, kill them.
I think that's what they should do. Many in Israel think that is what they should do. And I think that is what is going to have to end up happening, is a total renewal to the war and the, you know, occupation of the entire Gaza Strip as Israel destroys terrorist infrastructure and forcibly disarms Hamas. The main roadblock, well, there are two. The first one is the Iran war and Hezbollah's attacks in the north. This has just occupied a massive amount of Israeli attention over the last couple of months, really. And prevented them from really only now, when there's a ceasefire in Iran that, you know, as I'm sure you've talked about on other segments, may or may not hold in the near future. But only now have they been returning some level of focus to Gaza. But they're still on the footing of, we're fighting Iran. We're attacking the head of the snake right now. This is just a break. And they expect to have to go back to war with Iran. So that draws your focus away. The second main factor is Trump loves a deal, and he has thrown a lot of political and international political capital at this Board of Peace and seems to be committed to trying to make it work. There is going to come a point, though, and that point is approaching with the talks about disarmament even more rapidly. But there will come a point where it becomes clear to him that Hamas will never agree to a diplomatic solution. And at that point, you can only hope that the Board of Peace supports renewed military operations in Gaza, or they're trying a different tactic now, which they've floated before, but seems like they're moving towards, which is they're implementing the 20-point plan on the Israeli-controlled side of Gaza only. That's interesting. And if it's interesting to you, I'm happy to talk more about it. But the main problem is that only 2% of Gaza's population right now is within Israel's portion of the yellow line, and getting the rest, the other 98% there, without allowing Hamas to infiltrate is a very difficult task.
Bill, we have a couple of minutes.
Yeah, is that 2% amenable to, that is in the Israeli zone of control? Are they amenable to this? Do you think that, I mean, to me, that would make sense, even if it's a small, you could establish sort of an area where you could show this working, that the Israelis, or I'm sorry, the Palestinians have an autonomy and this peace plan is being implemented. It seems to me that would be beneficial. It could show others in the Hamas areas that there is something to this.
Yeah, I think that's the thinking, is that if you show a rebuilt side of Gaza, I mean, we've compared it to the Berlin Wall before, separating East and West Germany, and there was clearly one side that people wanted to be on, which is eventually why the wall came down, among other reasons. This would be similar if it's actually made into reality. It's a little unclear, again, because the 2% that's there, we don't know much about them, to be honest. There hasn't been a ton of reporting on this. You can assume that on some level they want to not live under Hamas rule enough to be in this part of Gaza. There could be other reasons, but that would make sense to me as an explanation. That isn't the issue. The issue is, how do you get almost 2 million people at this point to come across into your side of Gaza without Hamas also coming in with them? Now, Israel has great intelligence and tech and facial recognition software, but Hamas has been recruiting new members. There are older members who have rejoined. It would be a massive, probably multiple months long undertaking to effectively screen all of these people while they're waiting basically in line to leave, if Hamas even lets them leave. I mean, Hamas prevented a team to go towards a UAE-funded reconstruction effort in Rafah because they're terrified that people are going to actually leave Gaza, leave their part of Gaza and not come back. And then that's the worst PR nightmare for them ever, because you'd rather live under Israeli occupation than Hamas rule. So it's not something that they want, and they will try to prevent it.
Samuel Benner for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, a research analyst watching Gaza especially. Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow, FDD, my colleague and co-host. I'm John Batchelor. Great report, Sam.
Yeah.
Sam, detail about the Board of Peace. I didn't want to bring in politics at this moment, but it's going to come back. Is that now being openly laughed at?
I mean, not anything more so than how much people usually laugh at Trump. But they're, you know, they're trying. I'm not bullish on the Board of Peace, but I do think that they're going to come to the right conclusion on this. And Trump loves, you know, he wants deals. He'll sacrifice some strategic advantages for deals. But he also, anytime he does have to do something, you know, violent that he wouldn't want to do, he makes sure he shows him trying to do everything else before that. And I'm hoping that the Board of Peace is sort of the second thing. And then after Israel disarms Hamas, hopefully, then it can be a real force for good. I hope. We'll see.
Bill, Board of Peace, what do you hear?
I don't hear much about it at all, right? This is something that's been completely buried. But to Sam's point, I think this is something you have to try. If I was the Trump administration, I wouldn't invest too much political capital into it, wouldn't be too optimistic about it. But I do think you have to show that you made a final effort before you go in and do the dirty work to eliminate Hamas. The issue is not stretching it out too far. But as far as like talk about the Board of Peace in Washington or in America in general, I mean, Sam, you're more plugged in on this topic than I am, but I really don't hear much about it at all.
No, I mean, no one's talking about Gaza, sort of full stop. But when they do, they don't talk. They talk about Haddad being killed or Hamas disarmament. They don't talk about the border peace. Yeah, I think the real risk is, as you said, it draws out too long. And then there's a new president in office before Israel has disarmed Hamas.
And the killers that are sanctuary in Doha, is Israel ready to go to the Al Thani family and say, turn them over?
I think the Qatar is kicking them out anyway, but to Turkey, because they are pissed off that the Hamas leaders there didn't condemn Iran's strikes on Qatar. There was some reporting on that earlier in the war. We'll see if they mean it. I think that Israel missed their chance. They had the opportunity when they did their strikes in Qatar to take out that entire political echelon. They had them all in one building. And they, you know, I think Qatar like tipped them off. I don't think Israel has the political capital to do another strike like that, unfortunately. So they'll keep on, you know, they'll keep on talking it, but that's honestly, that's all they can do because they're not in Gaza. So,
okay. Okay. We'll come back to this. Thank you, Sam, for coming in. Bill, thank you very much. We'll meet again at 10.
I thought it was 10:30. Is that right?
10:30 for Bridget.
Yes.
And we're going to Iraq.
It'll be Bridget. Then I got Bridget, David, Hardy, Edmund, Ahmed, and then Joe at 2:30.
You got it. And thank you, Sam. And Roman Orchestra is wandering onto the stage here. All right, guys. I know I'm going to have to pay you overtime, but all right, fine. Union rules, Sam, that the orchestra holds me to the contract. And if I step out of bounds for a moment, they charge me twice. But I'll pay it this morning. Here we go. Thank you.
See you, gentlemen.
Here come the orchestra.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.